Welcome to the award-winning research podcast, where we dive deep into the latest scientific discoveries. I'm Tom, and with me as always is my co-host, Jen.
Hello everyone. Today we're excited to discuss a fascinating paper that explores an important question. Why do people often resist new policies, even when those policies are designed to benefit society as a whole?
The paper is titled Psychological Reactance to System-Level Policies Before and After Their Implementation, and it's authored by Armin Granulow, Christoph Fuchs, and Robert Bohm.
This research really gets to the heart of a key challenge that policymakers face. The authors found that people tend to show much stronger opposition to system-level policies, like bans, mandates, and taxes, before those policies are actually implemented, compared to after.
Exactly. The researchers saw this pattern play out across a variety of policy contexts, from restricting car use to increasing alcohol taxes. But the really intriguing part is that this psychological reactance seems to dissipate once the policies are actually in place.
That's right. The team used a combination of large-scale survey data, controlled experiments, and in-depth process tracing to uncover the psychological mechanisms underlying this phenomenon. And what they discovered has important implications for how we think about public opposition to system-level policies.
So let's dive in and explore this research in more detail. The core question the authors set out to answer was, why is psychological reactance to system-level policies greater before they're implemented versus after?
The researchers proposed that this effect can be explained through a transition heuristic framework. Essentially, when people anticipate a policy change that will restrict their individual choices or freedoms, they tend to focus more on what they'll personally lose in the transition, rather than on the potential societal benefits of the new policy.
That makes a lot of sense. It's that natural human tendency to focus on our own personal costs and inconveniences, rather than stepping back to consider the bigger picture.
Exactly. And the researchers found empirical support for this idea across multiple studies. For example, in one experiment, participants read about a proposed government policy to ban cars for commuting.
And when the policy was described as something that was just being planned for the future, people reported much higher levels of anger and reactance compared to when the policy was described as having already been implemented.
Right, and the key mediating factor seemed to be that before the policy was in place, people were more focused on the personal losses they would experience, like the inconvenience of not being able to drive to work. But after the policy was implemented, their focus shifted more towards the societal gains, like reduced emissions and safer streets.
That's a really fascinating finding. It suggests that a lot of the public opposition to these system-level policies may be more of a temporary, psychological phenomenon than a reflection of people's true, stable preferences.
Absolutely. And the researchers even found a way to leverage this insight to reduce reactance. In one study, simply making the societal benefits of the policy more salient helped mitigate people's anger and resistance, even when the policy was still just in the planning stages.
Wow, that's a really valuable practical implication. It shows that policymakers could potentially head off a lot of the backlash to their proposals by doing a better job of communicating the broader societal upsides.
Exactly. And I think this research also highlights just how complex human psychology can be when it comes to these kinds of policy changes. On the surface, you might expect people to just rationally weigh the costs and benefits. But there are all these deeper cognitive biases and mental shortcuts at play.
Definitely. The authors did a great job of unpacking those psychological processes in a really accessible way. I'm curious, Jen, what did you find most surprising or intriguing about this study?
Well, I was really struck by how consistent the findings were across such a wide range of policy contexts, from environmental regulations to public health measures. The fact that this pattern of greater pre-implementation reactance held up so robustly suggests there's something fundamental going on in how we psychologically process these kinds of system-level changes.
That's a great point. And I was also really interested in how the researchers were able to provide such clear evidence for their proposed mechanism. Being able to experimentally manipulate people's focus on personal losses versus societal gains, and see the corresponding shift in reactance, was a clever way to validate their theoretical account.
Absolutely. It's an elegant example of how rigorous, multi-method research can illuminate complex psychological phenomena. And I think the implications are so important, because these system-level policies are often exactly what's needed to tackle major societal challenges.
Definitely. If policymakers can find ways to get ahead of this psychological reactance, it could make a huge difference in their ability to actually implement the changes that are needed. This is a great example of how behavioral science can inform more effective policymaking.
Couldn't agree more. This is the kind of research that has the potential to make a real-world impact by helping us understand, and potentially overcome, some of the cognitive biases that so often derail important policy initiatives.
Absolutely. Well, listeners, I hope you're as fascinated by this research as we are. It really highlights the value of diving deep into the latest scientific discoveries and unpacking their broader relevance. Be sure to tune in next time as we explore another cutting-edge paper that's shaping our understanding of the world around us.
Yes, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on the award-winning research podcast.
In a hushed, dramatic voice, asterisk, are you tired of your personal freedoms being restricted by annoying new government policies? Well, have we got the solution for you?
In a chipper, sales Y tone introducing the psychological reactance reverser. This cutting-edge device uses advanced neurotechnology to override your brain's natural tendency towards resistance and opposition.
Still dramatic with the psychological reactance reverser, you'll be able to focus on the societal benefits of new policies, rather than just your own petty grievances.
Sweetly, no more anger, no more frustration, just pure, rational acceptance of government mandates. Order now and receive a free tinfoil hat to block out those pesky pro-policy propaganda messages.
Ominously, the psychological reactance reverser. Because your freedom to ignore the greater good is the most important freedom of all.
Cheerfully call 1-800-REACTANCE-B GONE to place your order today. Operators are standing by.
Welcome to the Curiosity Chronicles, where we dive deep into cutting-edge research and uncover the stories behind the science. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host Jen.
Hi everyone. In today's episode, we'll be exploring a fascinating paper that investigates a long-standing puzzle in the field of speech production research. The title of the paper is Semantic Interference in Blocked Picture Naming. Does it become cumulative with large local response sets?
This research was conducted by Stefan Wanner and Jörg Dejeshiniak from Leipzig University. They set out to understand why semantic interference, the phenomenon where naming a picture is slowed down by the recent naming of semantically related pictures, shows different patterns in two commonly used experimental tasks.
Specifically, in continuous picture naming, where participants name a large set of pictures only once, the semantic interference has been found to be cumulative. That is, the more semantically related pictures a participant has named, the slower they become at naming the next picture.
But in blocked picture naming, where participants repeatedly name a small set of pictures, the semantic interference has typically been found to be non-cumulative. It increases from the first to the second repetition, but then remains constant after that.
The researchers suspected that this difference might be due to the way participants use the small local response sets in the blocked picture naming task. When there are only a few pictures to remember, people can quickly establish a mental representation of the task, which may then be used to strategically bias the selection of the target picture.
This top-down process could potentially override the bottom-up effects that lead to cumulative interference. But what if the local response sets were much larger, making it harder for participants to quickly identify and memorize them? Would that allow the cumulative interference to emerge even in the blocked picture naming task?
That's exactly what Wohner and Jeshiniak set out to investigate. They created two versions of a blocked picture naming task, one with local response sets of 10 items and another with local response sets of 19 items. Let's dive into how they conducted these experiments and what they found.
In the first version, the standard blocked picture naming task, participants repeatedly named sets of 10 pictures that were either all from the same semantic category, the homogeneous context, or were a mix of different categories, the heterogeneous context.
The key finding here was that semantic interference did increase from the first to the second to the third repetition, but then remained constant after that. This was true even when looking at the pattern of naming latencies across the individual positions within each repetition.
Interestingly, this pattern was similar in the second version of the task, the blocked interleaved naming. In this version, the local response sets were even larger, comprising 19 items that were a mix of homogeneous and heterogeneous subsets. Again, the interference increased up to the third repetition and then plateaued.
The researchers had predicted that with these larger local response sets, which exceed the typical capacity of working memory, the strategic top-down processes would be less effective. This, in turn, should have allowed the cumulative nature of the interference to emerge, as observed in continuous naming studies.
But that's not what they found. Even with these large local response sets, the semantic interference did not continue to increase after the third repetition. Warner and Jeshniak were quite surprised by this result, as it challenges the idea that the use of small local response sets is the sole reason for the non-cumulative pattern in blocked naming.
One possible explanation the authors discuss is that there may be fundamental differences in how semantic interference arises in continuous naming versus blocked naming tasks. In continuous naming, the interference seems to build up gradually with each subsequent semantically related picture. But in blocked naming, there may be different processes at play, such as short-term facilitation that counteracts the longer-lasting inhibition.
The researchers also note that the way semantic interference is measured differs between the two tasks. In continuous naming, it's assessed by comparing the time to name a picture to the number of previously named same category items. But in blocked naming, it's the difference in naming times between the homogeneous and heterogeneous contexts.
This difference in measurement may contribute to the divergent patterns observed. Perhaps there is an upper limit to the amount of interference that can accumulate, and this limit is reached earlier in blocked naming than in continuous naming due to the way the effect is quantified.
Ultimately, this study highlights the complexity of the mechanisms underlying semantic interference in speech production. While the researchers' initial hypothesis was not supported, their findings raise important new questions about the task-dependent nature of these cognitive processes.
I found it really fascinating how the researchers tried to isolate the role of the local response sets, but even with much larger sets, the interference patterns didn't change as dramatically as they had expected. It just goes to show how subtle and nuanced these speech production mechanisms can be.
Absolutely. This study is a great example of how even when experiments don't turn out as predicted, they can still lead to valuable insights and new avenues for exploration. The researchers did an excellent job of carefully analyzing their results and considering multiple possible explanations.
One thing that really stood out to me was their discussion of the potential differences in how semantic interference arises in continuous naming versus blocked naming. The idea that there might be both facilitatory and inhibitory processes at play, with a complicated interplay between them, is quite intriguing.
Agreed. It really highlights the need for more research to tease apart these underlying mechanisms. This study may not have solved the puzzle, but it has certainly opened up new and exciting directions for future investigations into the cognitive underpinnings of speech production.
Definitely. The researchers have provided a valuable contribution to this field, and I'm sure other scientists will build on their work to continue unraveling the complexities of how we retrieve words from our mental lexicons. It's amazing how much we still have to learn about this fundamental aspect of human cognition.
Absolutely. Well, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this deep dive into the fascinating world of semantic interference in picture naming. It's a prime example of how scientific research can lead us to surprising and thought-provoking discoveries, even when the initial hypotheses aren't fully supported.
Yes, this is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the intricate processes involved in speech production. We're sure to see many more exciting developments in this field in the years to come. Thank you all for joining us on this episode of the Curiosity Chronicles.
Until next time, keep exploring and stay curious. And now, a word from our sponsor, Semantic Interference Inc.
Are you tired of those pesky semantic interferences slowing down your speech production? Well, have we got the solution for you?
Introducing Semantic Interference Inc.'s latest product, the Semantic Scrambler 3000.
This cutting-edge device uses advanced neurotechnology to disrupt the semantic connections in your brain, preventing those annoying word-finding difficulties.
Simply strap on the Semantic Scrambler 3000 and watch as your speech becomes lightning fast, leaving your friends and family in awe of your verbal dexterity.
No more pausing to find the right word or struggling to name that one object you just saw. The Semantic Scrambler 3000 will have you chatting away like a pro, completely immune to semantic interference.
But wait, there's more. Order in the next 20 minutes, and we'll throw in a free semantic blocker app for your phone, ensuring you never fall victim to those word-related woes again.
Don't let semantic interference hold you back. Get the Semantic Scrambler 3000 and experience the joy of unimpeded speech production. Call 1-800-BEAT-THAT-INTERFERENCE to order now.
Semantic interference, Inc. Keeping your words flowing, one semantic connection at a time. Podcast episode transcript, intro music. Welcome to the Curious Minds podcast, where we dive deep into the latest cutting-edge research and uncover the stories behind the science. I'm your host, Tom.
And I'm Jen. In today's episode, we're exploring a fascinating paper that sheds light on the hidden forces shaping our understanding of mindset. The title of the paper is Dominant Paradigms in the Field of Mindset by Ashley Buchanan.
This paper examines a critical but often overlooked aspect of the mindset field, the existence of dominant paradigms. As Buchanan explains, these dominant paradigms exert a powerful influence over how people perceive and understand mindset, often without their awareness.
That's right, Tom. Dominant paradigms can function like blinders, limiting our perspective and causing us to dismiss or overlook alternative ideas that don't fit within the dominant view. Buchanan argues that unpacking these dominant paradigms is key to unlocking a deeper, more inclusive understanding of mindset.
Absolutely. Let's dive in and unpack this paper's insights. Buchanan begins by sharing her own experience as a mindset researcher and practitioner. She explains how, during her university studies, she was inadvertently enrolled into a dominant paradigm of mindset, one that she didn't recognize until years later.
That's fascinating. It sounds like Buchanan's personal journey mirrors the broader trends she's observed in the field. Can you tell us more about what she means by a dominant paradigm in the context of mindset?
Great question. According to Buchanan, a dominant paradigm is the socially accepted, mainstream interpretation of a phenomenon that becomes entrenched within a field. In the case of mindset, these dominant paradigms shape how the majority of people understand, research, and apply mindset concepts.
I see. So it's almost like a collective mindset or worldview that gets passed down, even though there may be alternative perspectives out there. Can you give us some examples of how these dominant paradigms manifest in the mindset field?
Absolutely. Buchanan identifies several key indicators of dominant paradigms. For one, the way mindset is defined. She says that people conditioned by a dominant paradigm will typically only acknowledge the dominant, socially accepted definitions, rather than the full diversity of perspectives that exist.
That's really insightful. What are some other indicators she points to?
Another indicator is the way people use language like mindset theory or mindset research. Buchanan says that if someone refers to the work of just one person or tradition, without acknowledging the broader field, that's a sign of a dominant paradigm at play.
That's a subtle but important distinction. What else does she highlight?
Buchanan also looks at the stories people hold about the origins and history of mindset. She says that dominant paradigms tend to center around a few key figures, effectively excluding the rich lineage of contributors over time. In contrast, a more inclusive, evidence-based view would acknowledge that diverse history.
Fascinating. It's almost like these dominant paradigms create a kind of tunnel vision, where certain ideas and narratives get amplified while others are marginalized or forgotten. What other indicators does Buchanan provide?
Well, she also points to the way mindset is taught in educational settings. If a training or course only presents a single perspective, that's a sign of a dominant paradigm being passed down. Buchanan contrasts this with a more comprehensive, evidence-based approach that would expose learners to the full breadth of mindset ideas and theories.
I see. So dominant paradigms not only shape our individual understanding, but they can become entrenched in the very systems and institutions we rely on to learn about this topic. That's really thought-provoking.
Absolutely. Buchanan goes on to highlight a few more indicators, like the prevalence of hype and amazing claims around dominant paradigm ideas, versus a more critical, evidence-based approach. She also notes that dominant paradigms typically don't invite diverse perspectives, but rather ask people to adopt a specific worldview.
Wow, that's a lot of really insightful criteria for identifying dominant paradigms. It makes me wonder, how exactly do these paradigms become so dominant in the first place? What are the implications of their influence?
Great question. Buchanan explains that dominant paradigms often emerge in the early stages of a field's development, when there are many diverse interpretations of a phenomenon. Over time, one or more of these interpretations become socially accepted as the norm, while alternative views get pushed to the fringes.
I see. So it's almost like a natural tendency for certain ideas to gain traction and become entrenched, even if they don't necessarily represent the full picture. What are some of the key implications Buchanan highlights?
She points out a few critical implications. First, dominant paradigms can function as a filter, causing people to dismiss or overlook ideas that don't fit within the dominant worldview. This limits understanding and stifles the field's evolution.
That makes a lot of sense. What other implications does she identify?
Buchanan also notes that dominant paradigms set the standards for how most mindset research and interventions are approached. So the field ends up reinforcing the dominant logic, while alternative approaches get marginalized. This creates biases and power imbalances in the field.
Wow, that's really concerning. It's almost like these dominant paradigms become a self-fulfilling prophecy, perpetuating themselves through the very systems and practices they've shaped. No wonder Buchanan sees this as such an important issue to grapple with.
Absolutely. She's really trying to shine a light on this phenomenon and empower people to become aware of the dominant paradigms that may be shaping their understanding. Buchanan believes that by gaining this awareness, we can then start to transcend those paradigms and embrace new, more inclusive ways of understanding mindset.
That's fascinating. So what does Buchanan say is the value of becoming aware of dominant paradigms in the first place? Why is it so important?
Well, she cites the work of philosophers and systems thinkers like Thomas Kuhn and Daniela Meadows, who have found that paradigm awareness can be a crucial precursor to paradigm shifts, revolutionary changes in how a field understands and approaches a phenomenon.
Ah, I see. So by bringing these dominant paradigms to light, we open the door to potentially transformative shifts in the mindset field. That's really exciting.
Exactly. Buchanan argues that the mindset field is ripe for such a paradigm shift, but it requires people to be willing to critically examine the dominant views they've internalized, ask paradigm-upsetting questions, and embrace more diverse, evidence-based perspectives.
That's a powerful invitation. So in essence, Buchanan is challenging us as listeners to reflect on our own relationship to dominant mindset paradigms. What does she suggest we do about it?
Well, Buchanan encourages us to engage in a process of self-assessment, using the indicators she provided to examine whether we've been conditioned by dominant paradigms. She emphasizes the importance of compassion, as these paradigms can be deeply entrenched. But she also urges us to be courageous in questioning our assumptions and opening ourselves up to new ways of understanding.
That sounds like such an important and empowering process. I can see how unpacking these dominant paradigms could truly transform how we approach mindset, both individually and as a field. This paper really challenges us to think more critically and expansively about this topic.
Absolutely. Buchanan is essentially inviting us to be part of a social movement toward more inclusive, evidence-based understandings of mindset. It's an exciting prospect, and one that could have profound implications for how we research, teach, and apply mindset concepts in the world.
Well, listeners, there you have it, a deep dive into the hidden forces shaping our understanding of mindset. This is such a thought-provoking and important topic, and I'm really grateful to Buchanan for shedding light on it. We'll be sure to include links to her other relevant papers in the show notes, in case you want to continue exploring this further.
Absolutely. For now, let's take a moment to reflect on what we've learned. What are your key takeaways, Jen? What ideas or questions are you left with after this discussion?
Well, I'm struck by how easily we can all get conditioned by dominant paradigms without even realizing it. The idea that these powerful frameworks are silently shaping our worldviews is both fascinating and a little unsettling. I'm really intrigued by the possibility of triggering paradigm shifts through critical self-reflection and a willingness to embrace new perspectives.
Same here. I think this paper has made me much more attuned to the way I've internalized certain mindset concepts, and how that might be limiting my understanding. I'm excited to dig deeper, examine my own biases, and see what new insights and possibilities emerge when I start questioning the dominant narratives.
Absolutely. As Buchanan says, this work is about pioneering new pathways and developing more comprehensive, inclusive approaches to mindset. I'm inspired by the invitation to be part of that social movement toward greater awareness and evolution in this field.
Couldn't agree more. Will, listeners, thank you for joining us on this exploration of dominant paradigms in mindset. It's been a fascinating and thought-provoking discussion, and we hope it's left you with some valuable insights to ponder.
For now, we'll leave you with some reflective music to accompany your journey of self-discovery. Keep questioning, keep learning, and let's see what paradigm-shifting possibilities emerge. Until next time, this is Jen.
Dot and Tom, signing off. Happy exploring. Outro music. Upbeat jingle plays. Are you tired of the same old mindset advice? Do terms like growth mindset and fixed mindset make your eyes glaze over?
Introducing Paradigm Shifters, the revolutionary new company that's turning the mindset industry on its head.
At Paradigm Shifters, we believe that dominant paradigms have held us back for far too long. That's why we've assembled a team of maverick mindset experts, renegade researchers, and reality-bending philosophers.
Our mission? To help you break free from the mental shackles of the status quo and unlock your true, unbounded potential.
Are you ready to ditch the one-size-fits-all mindset mantras and explore the wild, uncharted frontiers of human consciousness?
Then step right up and get your Paradigm Shifter Starter Kit. Inside, you'll find the Thought Grenade, a revolutionary thought experiment that'll blow your mind, literally. The Perspective Prism, a kaleidoscopic lens that reveals hidden dimensions of reality, and the Dominant Paradigm Decoder Ring, because you deserve to crack the code of social conditioning.
All this can be yours for the low, low price of 3 easy payments of $19.95. But wait, there's more.
Call in the next 20 minutes, and we'll throw in the Paradigm Shifting Mixtape, a psychedelic symphony of mind-bending ideas that'll have you questioning everything you thought you knew.
So what are you waiting for? Break free from the mental matrix and claim your spot on the cutting edge of mindset evolution. Call 1-800-PARADIGM-SHIFT now.
Paradigm Shifters. Unlocking your limitless potential, one dominant paradigm at a time. Upbeat jingle fades out.
Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the latest cutting-edge research. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host, Jen.
Hello, everyone. Today, we're exploring a fascinating paper that sheds light on the factors behind the wide variation in fertility rates across different regions of England. The study is titled Accounting for Geographic Variation in English Period Fertility and was authored by John Ermish from Nuffield College, Oxford.
This paper tackles an important question. What's behind the huge differences in fertility that we see between local authority areas in England? The authors found that a substantial majority of this variation can be attributed to the ethnic and educational composition of the local populations. Let's dive in and learn more.
The researchers were intrigued by the fact that in 2022, the total fertility rate, or TFR, which represents the average number of children per woman, ranged from just 0.63 in the City of London all the way up to 1.98 in Barking and Dagenham. That's a massive difference.
Exactly. The authors wanted to understand what's driving these stark regional disparities. They proposed two main reasons why fertility might vary so much by local area.
The first has to do with the social composition of the population. We know that there are significant differences in fertility rates between different ethnic groups, with the highest rates among women of Pakistani, Bangladeshi, and Black African descent. So areas with larger concentrations of these groups would be expected to have higher overall fertility.
The researchers also found that more educated women tend to have lower fertility, with those holding university degrees exhibiting more childlessness, later childbearing, and lower completed family size. So regions with a higher proportion of degree-educated women were predicted to have lower fertility rates.
The second key factor the authors considered was the impact of local housing costs. The idea is that higher rents and home prices can discourage childbearing, both for tenants and homeowners. More expensive housing means a larger share of the family budget goes towards shelter, leaving less for raising children.
Right, and the authors explained that this effect can work in a few ways. For tenants, higher rents directly reduce the resources available for having and raising kids. For homeowners, rising prices increase the user cost of housing, making it more costly to occupy the home and thus reducing the affordability of having a larger family.
Intriguingly, the researchers also noted that housing costs can have the opposite effect in some cases. If higher home prices boost the housing equity and wealth of existing homeowners, that could actually encourage more childbearing as couples tap into that extra wealth.
That's a really interesting dynamic. The authors suggested that geographic mobility plays a role here. Couples with a stronger preference for children may be more inclined to move to lower-cost areas, leaving behind those with a lower desire for kids in the more expensive regions.
To investigate these ideas, the researchers conducted a detailed statistical analysis using data on fertility rates, ethnic composition, education levels, and housing costs for all 309 local authority areas in England. They used sophisticated spatial regression models to tease apart the complex relationships at play.
And what they found was quite remarkable. The authors were able to explain a surprisingly large proportion, around 70% of the variation in fertility rates across areas using just a handful of key variables. The main drivers were the ethnic and educational makeup of the local populations.
Specifically, they found that a higher percentage of ethnic Pakistani, ethnic other black, and ethnic Bangladeshi residents was associated with significantly higher fertility rates. Conversely, greater concentrations of ethnic Chinese and ethnic black Caribbean residents correlated with lower fertility.
The impact of education was also quite substantial. For every 1 percentage point increase in the share of adults with a university degree, the total fertility rate dropped by about 0.01 children per woman. That's a pretty sizable effect.
Interestingly, the researchers also looked at the role of local housing costs and found that they do have a negative impact on fertility, but it's relatively small compared to the compositional factors. Their analysis suggests that a 10% increase in median house prices would only reduce the fertility rate by about 0.002 children per woman.
That's a pretty modest effect, especially when you consider how much house prices have risen in many parts of England over the past decade or so. The authors think this housing cost impact may be inflated by the sorting of couples with stronger preferences for children into the more affordable areas.
Exactly. The researchers acknowledge that their findings likely reflect a combination of in situ responses to housing costs, as well as people self-selecting into areas that better match their fertility preferences. Disentangling those different mechanisms is a tricky challenge.
Overall, this study paints a really fascinating picture of the drivers of regional fertility variation in England. The authors were able to explain the majority of the differences simply by looking at the ethnic and educational composition of local populations. Housing costs play a role, but seem to be a relatively minor factor compared to these demographic factors.
I found it really intriguing how the researchers were able to tease apart the complex web of influences at play here. The sophisticated spatial regression models they used allowed them to account for things like the spillover effects of fertility from neighboring areas. It's a great example of how rigorous quantitative analysis can shed light on important real-world phenomena.
Absolutely. And I think the policy implications of this work are quite significant. If we understand that fertility differences are primarily driven by the social and demographic makeup of local areas, then that points to different types of interventions than if it was mainly about housing affordability.
That's a great point. This research suggests that initiatives targeted at changing the ethnic or educational composition of an area may be more effective at influencing fertility levels than policies focused narrowly on housing costs. It's a nuanced and complex issue, but this study takes us a big step forward in accounting for the geographic variation we see.
Definitely. This was a really impressive piece of research that combined strong theoretical framing, rigorous empirical methods, and insightful interpretation of the results. It's a great example of how academic studies can illuminate important real-world phenomena in a compelling and accessible way.
I couldn't agree more. This paper is a fantastic demonstration of how expert analysis and narrative storytelling can come together to shed light on cutting-edge discoveries. It's been a pleasure diving into this research with you, Tom. I think our listeners have gained a deep and engaging understanding of the factors behind regional fertility differences in England.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for joining me today, Jen. This was a fascinating exploration of a really important issue. I'm sure our listeners are as intrigued as we are by the insights this study has uncovered. We'll be back soon with more thought-provoking research. Stay tuned.
Looking forward to it. Until next time, happy listening, everyone.
And now, a word from one of our sponsors. Upbeat jingle plays. Announcer. Are you tired of feeling like the odd one out in your neighborhood? Worried that your family size just doesn't match the local norm? Introducing Relocation Concierge, the one-stop shop for finding your fertility-friendly dream home. Whimsical sound effect. Announcer. At Relocation Concierge, our team of expert demographers and housing analysts will scour the country to find the perfect location for your growing family. Whether you're looking to boost your baby-making potential or escape the clutches of university-educated, childless millennials, we've got you covered. Sound of a cash register. Announcer. Just tell us your desired fertility rate, educational background, and ethnic composition, and we'll match you with the neighborhood that fits like a glove. No more worrying about housing costs cramping your childbearing style. Let Relocation Concierge find you a spacious, affordable home in a kid-friendly oasis. Jingle returns. Announcer. Relocation Concierge. Because your fertility shouldn't be shackled by your zip code. Call or click today.
Wow, that was unique. I'm not sure I'd want a service that explicitly caters to people based on their ethnic background and education level. Seems like it could promote some pretty problematic dynamics.
Huh, yeah, you've got a point there. The way they framed it was definitely a bit off the wall. But I guess the underlying idea of helping people find affordable areas that align with their family planning goals isn't the worst concept. Though the execution leaves something to be desired.
Definitely. Maybe they could rebrand and focus more on general family-friendly community analysis, rather than getting into the weeds of demographic profiling. There's probably a way to do it that's more inclusive and less, well, bizarre.
Absolutely. With a little refinement, I could see a service like that being genuinely useful for a lot of people. But for now, I think I'll pass on Relocation Concierge. Time to move on to our next sponsor.
Sounds good to me. Up next, a word from the makers of our favorite family-sized beverages. Stay tuned, everyone.
Hello and welcome to the Inquiring Minds podcast, where we dive deep into cutting-edge research and uncover the fascinating stories behind the science. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host, Jen.
Hi, everyone. Today, we're excited to explore a remarkable study that reveals unexpected parallels between human language and whale communication. The paper is titled Language-Like Efficiency in Whale Communication and was authored by Mason Youngblood.
This study investigates a fascinating concept called Menzerath's Law, which predicts that longer sequences, like songs or words, will be made up of shorter elements, like notes or phonemes. The researchers wanted to see if this linguistic principle holds true for the vocalizations of a wide range of whale species, from the majestic humpback to the enigmatic sperm whale.
What's really intriguing is that Menzerath's law is thought to be a manifestation of communicative efficiency, the idea that communication systems evolve to maximize the benefits they provide while minimizing the costs of learning and producing them. So by looking at whether whale vocalizations adhere to this law, the researchers were able to gain insights into the underlying pressures shaping these incredible acoustic displays.
To tackle this question, the researchers compiled a vast dataset, analyzing over 600,000 individual elements and intervals from the vocal sequences of 16 different whale species. This included everything from the haunting songs of the humpback whale to the burst pulse calls of dolphins.
And what they found was truly remarkable. 11 of the 16 whale species in the study exhibited Menzerath's law to a degree that was comparable to, and in some cases even exceeded, what we see in human language. That's a pretty stunning result when you consider the vast evolutionary distance between us and these marine mammals.
For example, the researchers looked at humpback whale song at two different levels, the notes within phrases and the phrases within the overall song. At both levels, they found a strong negative relationship between sequence length and element duration, perfectly in line with Menzerath's law.
But the story gets even more fascinating when you look at how the whale's vocalizations change over the course of a sequence. Rather than the typical pattern seen in human language, where elements get longer towards the end, the whales actually tend to shorten their elements and intervals as the sequence progresses.
The researchers suggest this vocal shortening may be driven by simple energetic constraints. Producing longer vocalizations is more costly, so the whales appear to be optimizing their acoustic displays for efficiency. This physical origin for Menzies' law is a really intriguing idea that challenges some of the traditional explanations we've seen in human language.
It's incredible to think that these marine mammals, separated from us by millions of years of evolution, have independently converged on communication strategies that mirror the principles underlying human speech. It really speaks to the powerful evolutionary pressures that shape efficient systems of information exchange.
And the implications go beyond just whales. The fact that Menzies' law isn't a universal feature of human language, but rather a statistical tendency, suggests that these types of communicative constraints may be a common thread across diverse biological systems.
Absolutely. This study opens up so many fascinating questions about the fundamental principles governing vocal communication, and how those principles are shaped by the unique physical and behavioral adaptations of different species. It's a wonderful example of how comparative research can illuminate the shared patterns and processes underlying communication, from whales to humans.
Well, Jen, this has been a truly captivating exploration of the language-like efficiency in whale communication. I'm left with a deep appreciation for the incredible complexity and sophistication of these marine mammals, and a renewed curiosity about the universal principles that govern the evolution of communication in the natural world.
Me too, Tom. This paper is a fantastic reminder that the more we investigate the acoustic worlds of other species, the more we can learn about the common threads that unite all forms of vocal communication. I can't wait to see what other fascinating insights emerge as we continue to unravel the mysteries of whale song and beyond.
Absolutely. Well, that's all the time we have for today, but be sure to tune in next week as we dive into another fascinating piece of research. Until then, keep exploring, keep learning, and keep your mind inquiring. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone. Take care.
Whimsical jingle plays. Are you tired of your whale communication sounding stale and inefficient? Then you need the brand new Menzies Whale System.
Menzies Whale uses advanced vocal optimization algorithms inspired by cutting-edge whale research to ensure your underwater messages are as concise and melodic as the pros.
With Menzies Whale, your whale songs will automatically shorten elements and intervals as the sequence progresses, just like real whales. No more wasting precious breath on long, drawn-out vocalizations.
Impress your cetacean friends and confuse your human ones with the power of Menzies Whale. Available now in a variety of irresistible whale-inspired scents, like Ambergris Allure and Krill Delight.
Menzies Whale communicating like a boss, while smelling like the ocean. Get yours today. Asterisk whimsical jingle fades out.